Broadcasting from Boston, Massachusetts, you're listening to the Technology Equals Equality Podcast.
Welcome back to the Technology Equals Equality Podcast. I'm your host, Lori Brooks, and this is episode 37. So what happens when you mix philosophy with artificial intelligence? Well, here to answer that question is Donna Vinterfallen, founder and CEO of Owl Intel.
Welcome and thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you very much for this opportunity, Lori.
Oh, certainly. So Donovan, please share with us a story of how it is you once saw the future before you ever began thinking about building out a business of any sort. I know that you are founder of Owl Intel, but prior to Owl Intel, prior to your entrepreneurial journey, what did you think the future would look like for you?
It's a great question. Prior to Owl Intel and this entrepreneurial journey that I'm on, I was, as an undergrad, a philosophy major. That's a funny major in the sense that you can't do much with it. You can become a professor, or you can do things related to ethics. So that's the route I went after I graduated. I thought of what I could do with it, and I really liked the medical field, in particular nursing homes. That's what they're typically called. They're called skilled nursing facilities and subacutes, which is one step below an acute hospital. So that's what I did. I started off as a medical records designee and worked my way up to being an administrator, which is basically running the building based on the various fields of branches of philosophy that I learned. But my area of concern was bioethics and how it applies to helping people in, you know, improve their quality of life as regards to medical care. At some point, my father got sick. He got cancer, and I admitted him to the facility that I was running at the time. That was about 3.5 years ago. So that was a little much. After a decade in the profession, I felt like I wanted to do something different. So having the background in philosophy, and I have a passion for computers and programming, so I decided to sign up for a master's degree. While I was doing my master's, I was early on, the very first semester, I wanted to do what they call a master's thesis, which is basically a paper. It looks good on a resume, and I couldn't find a professor that wanted to do what I wanted to do, which was build an AI database at first. So then when I looked around me, I realized that a lot of people were doing startups, and so I decided to do a startup based on what I'd learned in philosophy as far as the mind works and as far as what I was learning in terms of my major was information systems, which is, it means different things in different colleges, but basically it's a little bit of programming, but it's more generalized. It teaches you about hardware and software from a business standpoint. And so that's how it got started.
So you initially were studying philosophy.
Yes.
And once you obtained your degree in philosophy, you came out not really sure as to which direction you wanted to go with the philosophy. So you went towards the medical field, and you worked your way up to becoming a medical records admin. And after, you know, almost a decade in the industry at that point, you realized that you really wanted to move further with what you were doing with the philosophy, and also the fact that you were interested in building out an AI database. And just to recap for the audience's sake, the AI database is referring to an artificial intelligence database. At that point, what were your thoughts as to what the database itself would be?
Right. So let me just clarify one thing before I answer that question. I was actually an executive administrator, which means I ran the entire hospital. I reported directly to the corporate CEO, so I was actually beyond the director of medical records. Everyone answered to me, and I answered to the corporate office. But answering your question, what I realized was that I was taking on a huge challenge because there's the AI field, which is, you can specialize in that. There's databases. So right off the bat, the very first semester, what I wound up doing was the first year, research the problem of what does it mean to say artificial intelligence? What is that problem? And so that was from August 2012 to 2013. Then I spent the next year coming up with a solution, and that fast-forwarded me to August of 2014, and then in December I did a Kickstarter campaign. I got funded in a day, which was a very modest 10,000, 30-day, but there was interest, and then from ending of December of 2014 to now, I've built a team, and I'm on the verge of having a prototype for people to use. The site right now is just a teaser site. But to answer your question about databases, basically the way it works is, when you're answering questions and when it comes to technology companies, there's a lot of ruthlessness that goes on that people don't talk about because they either work for the companies or they don't want to, ruffle any feathers. But the reality of the situation, if you look at it objectively, is the Larry Ellisons, the Bill Gates, and on and on, Steve Jobs, they're ruthless businessmen, and that's not a compliment. So what I'm saying is databases early on were, for example, with Larry Ellison, who's no doubt extremely wealthy, he's retired, he was the CEO and basically the founder of Oracle for a long time, has his own island, right, Hawaiian chain of islands. The point is, when he launched it, he said it was 2.0, but there was no 1.0. So you can see, objectively, if someone studies it, there's a lot of deception going on. That really turned me off to wanting to pursue it, but I did. So then there's what I realized was there's different kinds of databases. There's a database that it's proprietary that you pay for, which is dominated by Oracle, not so much anymore. And then there's what they call NoSQL, which is a deceptive term itself, which means not only SQL, which is SQL, which is the basically it's kind of like a programming language that databases use to collect information, process it somehow, and give people index it, they call it, and give people results. The bottom line is I realize that making an AI database is not where it's at. I was asking the wrong question. The right question to ask was what kind of AI is out there and what's the problem with it? And that answer is things like chess, driverless car, credit card transaction. There's different types of AI meant to solve different problems. But the overall one is how does a human being think? How can you code it and how can you apply it to an app, to a social platform, to a database, and to robots and cars? That line of questioning led me to realize that people were asking the wrong questions, which is people thought we think with our brain, we use mathematical logic, and one of the pioneers of it was a guy named McCarthy. So he's the one who actually founded the AI school in MIT. Then he was recruited on over to Stanford. He came up with the phrase artificial intelligence. It was a famous conference in Dartmouth. He came up with a programming language called Lisp. But what I'm saying is he used mathematical logic, and he thought we think with our brain, and he was of the school of thought, which most people are, that we're evolved animals. That holds true to all the big shots running, like, for example, Microsoft, as an example. It's Horowitz, right? He's the guy who runs the AI. He's been running it for a long time. Highly educated, respected man. He's not only a medical doctor, but he's also a AI expert. He's all over the place on the web. But what I'm saying is my solution is that instead of using brain thinking, I know better, because I studied philosophy, we think with our minds. And instead of using mathematical logic, I actually use philosophy in the sense of the branch of cognitional theory, epistemology, metaphysics, and ethics to solve the problem of how we think, coding that, and then now instead of making a database, actually I'm building out an app and then a social platform. An app for people to create content and a social platform for people to share and curate it. But as they're creating any type of content, the app is teaching them how their mind works. So there's a very dynamic thing that's happening. I hope that answered the question.
It certainly does. In fact, that's what I was going to, you know, it was looking for, is just kind of a more in-depth look as to how it is you're anticipating the platform itself to function. And from what I understand, which is why I was so interested in having you on, it seems as though the app is going to be an app in which functions very similar to a platform such as Facebook or Twitter, where you are able to enter information and blog and keep track of, you know, the same things that you would on a regular social network. However, this social network in particular is going to really give you an insight as to who you are and the details behind how you perform on a day-to-day basis and how you think. What was it that really sparked this idea for you? What was it that really sparked the transition in your questioning, in your research, that led you to solve the situation of how it is to go about coding the way we are thinking?
That's a great question. What it was for me was very simple. I was very frustrated with my not being a digital native, in the sense of I was in my early 20s when Windows 95 came out, and it made the web portion of the internet, because the internet is many things. It's file transfer, it's email, chat, instant messaging, and then the web is the most popular component of it, with the exception of email that's used more, historically speaking, anyways. So what happened was, basically, I was very frustrated with what it can do in general. I didn't appreciate the results I was getting from search engines, and I didn't appreciate the capabilities that the existing social media platforms give me. The way I saw the situation is that it's a chaotic situation, and what companies typically are doing is trying to corner the market versus doing something in terms of building a great service or product that adds value to people's lives. Now, having said that, it's quite ambitious, so it goes beyond Facebook, Twitter, Google, and let me be real succinct in explaining that. If you look at Web 1.0, and the reason why I'm talking about that is because I envision my company being Web 3.0. But how so? So let me explain briefly, if I may. So Web 1.0 was basically a bunch of technically called hyperlinks. You click this, you click that, and you go here and there. You see a bunch of text everywhere, although there was some images. And if you look at pioneers like Mark Andreessen of Netscape, which basically Microsoft crushed, that's Ben's and Mark's own words on YouTube. I mean, the stuff is like, you can find it, them saying it themselves. So it's not an opinion on my part. It's what they say. So it could be their opinion, but I believe them and it's factual. So and it's generally called the web browser wars, or there's different ways of saying it. So what I'm saying is the Web 1.0 evolved to Web 2.0. Then you had what we have today, which is in real time, you go online, I go online, billions of people go online. And what they do is they not only create content, but curate it and then share it. Hence all the popularity of various social medias, from MySpace, Friendster, and then the juggernaut of today is obviously Mark Zuckerberg's Facebook, him and his team, right? Now, having said that, the way I envision Web 3.0 is very simple. People that actually define a search engine, that's not what a real search engine is. So let me explain. So what Google does is not, strictly speaking, a search engine, because search engine is an intelligent agent that acts on your behalf. So paying money and popularity is not an intelligent agent. That's just making money. That's how I look at it, to keep things simple. The way I envision Web 3.0 is this way. So, for example, Lori Brooks, you have an AI avatar of yourself. It's not autonomous from you like Siri or any of the other solutions that are currently in vogue with the Facebooks. And Facebook has M. It's a little bit different than Microsoft, as well as Google Now, as well as Apple Siri. My AI is, it's you, an artificial extension of you, and you interact with it, but it's not autonomous from you. It's a part of you. It thinks perfectly, but it helps you along the way. Now, besides that, the other thing it does is there's always a machine learning component that's mysterious to a lot of people, but not to people who understand machine learning. It's not the same thing as AI. Machine learning is like basically learning, and AI is basically artificial intelligence that could be like the mind. So it could be, as mind is to AI, machine learning is to the understanding of that. And that's how I went about. So we first start with an app, then we branch out into a social platform, and then eventually search engine, then eventually we actually crawl the web, deconstruct everything, and then reconstruct it in terms of insights. So that when you get results from a social platform standpoint, it won't be Alan Tell's guess of what you think. It'll be based on your psychological, philosophical, and spiritual profile that you create yourself, and the learning algorithm does countless permutations and basically will give you a result that is not a mathematical guess, but more a simulation or a mimicking of the way a human being thinks in general, but you think in particular, if that makes sense.
It certainly does. I'm curious how it is you're anticipating the app itself being integrated into the daily use of your target market at this point.
Right. So if you're asking me to describe how it actually works, it's wanting to be a platform, which is, add value to people's lives and have a better solution, you can start from any level. So, for example, a simple post. If you take Twitter, it's 140 characters with handle, which is a name, their handles, which could be, silly things that you can't even figure out who the person is typically based on the handle, with a limit. So there's a lot of limitations, and really, to me, it's just like a big mess. With Facebook, you can say the same thing. For example, like Mark Zuckerberg talks about dislike button. So what I'm saying is programmers that try to solve things and they don't have a background in psychology, philosophy, they don't know the way the mind works, the solution they come up with is basically a mess. It's not comprehensive. It's a good first start, but it's not a comprehensive solution that's based on the way reality really is. Because in reality, we're not mathematical equations. And so on my platform, for example, if you see a post, when you post something, you have up to 1,000 characters. Then you have what we call horizon tags, which is feelings, emotions, and then there's subcategories of that. Or there's child options to parent options. And what that means is it doesn't matter what feeling, emotion, or spirit, what I call spiritual, which is a person could be an atheist, an agnostic, a Christian, a particular branch of Christianity or Islam. So they're able to express on one post the vast spectrum of what I call horizons. There's nothing really original that's been used. So just as a horizon is the range of your limit, it's the range and limit of what you know and you care about. I wanted to give people, from a granular standpoint, the ability to post something and tag it in a dramatic way. But yet, if you look throughout the platform, you can set goals, you can import your insights to those goals, you can create content in terms of blogs, in terms of groups. It's an amazing overall comprehensive solution. So it's really difficult to just talk about one little thing and present it like as better sameness, which is a Guy Kawasaki term. So I'm not doing better sameness. I'm doing what Guy Kawasaki would say, jumping the curve. So it's like going from horses to cars, or from dot matrix to laser printing, or from laser printing to 3D printing.
Donovan, that's why I was excited. This is it's the next big thing, and to be able to have you here to explain it to the audience, you know, and give us an inside look at Owl's Insight prior to, you know, fully launching and getting out there is very exciting. So once again, I do thank you for sharing with us. What do you feel was one of the most important pieces to getting this program up and running, to getting the business up and off the ground? What do you feel would be one of the more important pieces that you would advise a new entrepreneur to focus on when embarking on their own journey?
Okay, so you're welcome, and I appreciate the opportunity. It's my pleasure. So I would say that it's, as people know, it's not an easy thing. But having studied, so it's not, there's a lot to it. First of all, the very first thing is a man or a woman, regardless of age, you know, teens, 20s, 30s, 40s, and so on, they have to be very honest with themselves. So they first have to ask, what are the talent or talents that I have? So in other words, there's, a person has to have the talent first to be able to cultivate the talent. But that being said, assuming that a person has the talent to be able to do something mediocre or to great, they have to first be passionate, and then they wrap their passion around their talent, because it takes a lot of hard work. If someone is not doing a startup, an entrepreneurial spirit with and looking at it as a labor of love, then they're going to give up because it's a very difficult thing. Now, having said that, let's just assume, for example, in my case, it was a technology company. So you need about, I would say, five things. One is if a person is not quote-unquote technical, which is a fancy way of saying they don't know software engineering, programming, graphic design. So to borrow from the late and great Steve Jobs, you need four things. One, you need to know software engineering from the standpoint of analysis. You analyze the situation. What is the problem? What is the solution? Problem is the question. Solution is the answer. So that's the first thing. You need an analyst, software engineer, slash programmer. Two, you need a graphic designer. Three, you need a marketer, advertising. And that's not the same thing as four, which is a social media evangelist to evangelize the good word of the product or service that you're selling. If you have those four components of the programmer, the graphic designer, the social media person, well, I actually said the advertiser, slash marketer, and the social media evangelist, then the fifth thing you need is basically to have that entrepreneurial mindset. And I'd recommend a person studying someone of the caliber of, let's say, Stephen Covey, for example, although I'm not particularly subscribing to his thinking. The reason why I say that is because you have to have that entrepreneurial spirit. So for Covey, you could say live, learn, love, leave a legacy. In that very brief, succinct phrase, it encapsulates the vastness of his teachings, which is very well known. There are others, but you need to find, besides those four things I said, the fifth thing is you need to find a first-rate, high-performance mentor that it'll be a virtual mentor to the entrepreneur. I think if those things are there, then the probability of success increases manifold.
Definitely. I would agree 100%. I think having a positive mindset is very key, and then to be able to surround yourself with others who not only have that mindset but are capable of facilitating their own strength in a manner that can assist you in producing your end goal, it's definitely a recipe for success. So, Donovan, the show is really designed to help entrepreneurs come up with new business ideas for different companies and you know, to move forward in their own fields, much like you have with the Owl Insight. And I'm, again, very excited to see where this goes in the future. But right now, I'd love to know how it is that we might be able to help you. So if you had a magic wand and could change anything at all in your business, what would it be and why?
That's a great question. I'm going to answer it. I think you might be surprised. I wouldn't change anything. The reason I say that and why, right? So the reason why I say that is there's a fundamental distinction between, again, borrowing from Guy Kawasaki, better sameness, which is a majority of what people do, versus innovation, which is a term like empower or a revolution in the sense of technology, not a political type of thing. These terms get thrown around and they lose their meaning. But what I'm doing is what most people wouldn't dare to do, is doing something innovative. When you do something like that, then it's going to take a lot of time, a lot meaning not a year, a little more than that, because what you're doing is you're confronting what already exists, and people are creatures of habit, and they don't want to change things. The status quo goes on. But at the same time, bringing in a new, another cliche is paradigm shift, the model of the way of thinking. So most people think that Facebook is a majority of the web, then it would be Google. So these two being the case, and the horrible experience that I've had with them to this day, I don't think of them as like something amazing and stunning. I think of them as heaps of and I'm not the only one to say this. So if you take other people that they think the same way. That's how they come up with great stuff. So what I'm saying is I wouldn't change anything because I know it's hard going, and the way you win is basically one customer or user at a time. It doesn't cost anybody. See, it's free. So it doesn't cost anyone to stop using or dramatically decrease the amount of time that they're putting into an app, a social media platform, or even a search engine. That's what people don't get, and it's something very simple. So what I'm saying is I wouldn't change anything because I know it's hard going, and at Al and Tell, we win users, one user at a time, because we provide something that's superior, and it doesn't cost any money. And people can argue, well, at some point, MySpace dominated. I'll give you three examples, if I may. I know you didn't ask this question, but a lot of people can't understand how a company can be huge, worth multiple billions in an international conglomerate, and fail. Well, it's very simple. Where's Kodak? Where's so many others? Blockbuster, AOL. So what happens is the reason why they fail is because of culture. If you know Emil Durkheim, he says, when mores, which I substitute for culture, quoting him out of context in the tech field, is when culture is, when mores are sufficient, laws are unnecessary. When mores are insufficient, laws are unenforceable. So within the culture of, let's say, and I love Apple. I have profound respect for Jobs and Cook and, you know, all these folks. But their culture sucks. How do I know that? Because people that studied Apple, that wrote books on Apple, that's what they say across the board. So when you have huge companies with bad culture, and then they try to enforce their rules and regulations, it's the law of the unenforceable. Whereas with my platform, even though I have a very small team, I'm inculcating a type of culture that's conducive to living, to put it in Covey terms, right? Live, learn, love, and leave a legacy, but doing it openly and transparently, not like the Microsoft of the past. I give Satya a lot of credit. He's doing really great, although he looks like Steve Jobs with the way he dresses, and if you look at the latest stuff, it's just, for me, just copying Apple. So I'm not impressed in that sense. So to me, it's not a question of numbers and money, it's a question of culture and the way, just like with Kodak and so many others, destroyed themselves. Not only did they not innovate, but the reason why they didn't innovate because they had a cancerous culture. And that's what all of these have. I mean, if you go down to San Francisco, which I've been, if you just look at the way that people act and talk, it's filled with arrogance. And that's just the reality of the situation. So, like, I'm more like a Gary Vaynerchuk in the sense of I say it like it is, although I don't use profanity. I have sugarcoating and diplomacy, and I'm a little bit different than him in a lot of ways, but I definitely am the rawness that you see with him, you see with me, so you're not going to get, you know, the fancy, like, for example, if I may real quick, so if you ask Facebook, like Cheryl, right, any question you ask her, I guarantee you, you'll get a story of at least three stories of some poor person in typically India and Pakistan, or of course Africa, let's not forget there, and how Facebook changed their lives. You'll never hear like the average middle class, lower middle or upper middle class here in the U.S. And for them, you know, they don't even use it. So what I'm saying is, my approach is the simple truth, and there's no sugarcoating whatsoever. And believe it or not, that appeals to a lot of people that are just being fed a marketing campaign of a portrayal of how they are, but in reality, they're the total opposite.
Donovan, thank you. You have been absolutely wonderful this morning. Please share the best way for our listeners to find you.
So I'm active on Twitter, which people will tell me, a majority of people, I don't get Twitter. I mean, twit@owlintel.com, or they could just go to owlintel.com, and they below, it's just a teaser website right now meant to encourage people and inspire them to sign up for the upcoming closed beta test. So they can click on the link to Facebook or Twitter, and mainly I'm active on those platforms. Our Owlintel page on Facebook, or the Owlintel page on Twitter. That's how they could follow me if they care to connect with me. And at this point, it's early on in the game, so I'm not overwhelmed that I don't reply to people. Most people are very nice, but of course you're always going to get the occasional troll and lurker and hater. But, you know, we meaning me and my team and most people, they handle that with dignity and grace.
Well, thank you, Donovan. I will be sure to link to all of those in the show notes. But again, just thank you so much for your time and for sharing with our listeners today.
It was my pleasure, Lori. I thank you for the opportunity.
So if you would like to be a part of the beta test and get an inside look at Owl Intel, please pop on over to owlintel.com. You can always reach Donovan through our show notes page at technologyequality.com/Donovan or Falian. Donovan, thank you once again for sharing with us and giving us this inside look at the Web 3.0. And techie community, thank you for joining me week after week. I truly appreciate all of the support. If you guys are enjoying the show, pop on over to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating and review. I would love to hear your feedback about the show. And until our next episode, when we continue to hear the journey, find the pain, and create solutions, enjoy the week.